This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, February 3rd. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Very glad to have you joining us today. Coming up this week, we'll look east-southeast for an update from the state's capital.
It's everybody's priority to get something done this year in a significant way. What that something done is going to be a matter of time.
Others from our region who have traveled down or are in Juneau now offer thoughts on what they're seeing play out as lawmakers wrestle again with how to manage a $3 billion deficit.
It can't be done with just cuts. It can't be done with just revenue. It needs to be a combination of cuts and revenue. I think most legislators are on board with those ideas.
We'll get more reaction on the draft borough feasibility study for the Dillingham census area. Plus, the Dillingham City Council has voted to appeal the Local Boundary Commission's recent decision to deny its annexation petition. Those stories, plus a writer puts down her pen. We'll remember the Unalaska police blotter, which is going on an indefinite hiatus.
Officers investigated a report of an assault that occurred between two besotted individuals. The two had a disagreement concerning one of the sots consuming the alcohol of the other sot.
That's all coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. Governor Bill Walker tapped Dillingham's Fritz Johnson for a seat back on the state's Board of Fisheries. Johnson served one term on the board before Walker bumped him last year, giving Kenai's Robert Ruffner the seat instead. That made for the first time Bristol Bay did not have representation on the board. If he's approved by the legislature, Johnson and John Jensen of Petersburg will be the only two commercial fishermen on the Board of Fish, a voice Johnson says is important to have on there.
Absolutely, yes. You know, I'm intrigued by the legislation that's been introduced to expand the board, but in these troubled times that may not happen. No, but the commercial fishing industry is it's the largest employer in the state, and I think we do need adequate representation there.
Johnson has been named to fill the seat being vacated by Sue Jeffrey of Kodiak, who is stepping down after two terms. Governor Walker also put Jensen and Reed Morisky up for reappointment. After more than two dozen eruptions since mid-December, the Bogoslaw volcano finally dumped ash on its nearest community, Unalaska. Only about a millimeter or less was recorded from Monday's eruption. Christy Wallace at the AVO says scientists don't worry much over ashfall until it's several millimeters deep, adding that it's been quite a while since the Restless volcano has produced that much.
The last report of that amount of ash was in 1906 from a Bogoslaw eruption. There was, I think, 6 millimeters of ash, so that would be considered significant, and we would want to be monitoring the situation at that point.
The ash from Monday's eruption did disrupt some air travel in the early part of the week. There was good news after a plane went missing Sunday on a trip from Anchorage to the Kenai Peninsula. The Cessna 180 was found Monday, and all three on board survived the crash with no major injuries reported. A large search and rescue effort was out Sunday night and Monday morning looking for the downed aircraft, whose exact location was hard to find on account of an older model 121.5 megahertz ELT being used. So says National Guard spokesman Staff Sergeant Edward Egerton.
They send out a signal, and they're picked up by other aircraft flying around. But depending on, you know, the altitude of the aircraft, the strength of the signal, and so on and so forth, it can leave kind of a large area to search. Whereas, like, the 406s will send a signal right up to a satellite and practically give you driving instructions to the location.
No cause has yet been given for the crash. The pilot and two passengers were transported by the Coast Guard back to Anchorage. A bill that would add another layer of review to the Bristol Bay Forever ballot initiative had its first hearing in the House Fisheries Committee this week. Anchorage Representative Andy Josephson sponsored HB 14 and offered his take on what it would do.
We're going to apply the world's best and most advanced science, and it does that by saying that the three lands commissioners, DNR, DEC, and DFNG, must have independently reviewed studies prepared. Those studies must be interagency, and they must be peer-reviewed such that they are scientifically supportable.
The Pebble Partnership said the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative and Josephson's added protections amount to a legislative veto of the state permitting process, which CEO Tom Collier called unconstitutional. One of the state's recently released wood bison was shot and killed last Friday outside of Quinnahock. Named number 124, the wandering cow had traveled a long way from the release point and, according to the state, had captured the hearts of Western Alaska along the way. State wildlife troopers have filed poaching charges against the alleged shooter, and the cow's meat has been donated. Finally, a short film shot around Naknek about the way of life in Bristol Bay was screened at a film festival in Finland last weekend. The Last Walk was directed by Anna Hoover, who says the community rallied around the project during principal filming last fall.
In my film, the accident happened on a gill net on the water, and we were fortunate that the community opened their arms and allowed us to borrow a boat and borrow a skiff to get to the boat. And then there's airplanes in there, so we had pilots that were helping and landing on beaches. And, you know, in that way, as far as transportation, I feel like it accurately shows a glimpse of our life in Bristol Bay.
Hoover, who lives in Naknek and fishes in Igigik, is part of the Arctic Film Circle, a partnership of 9 indigenous filmmakers from the Arctic and subarctic region. She's an artist, and this was her first foray into filmmaking. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. If you can look past the blaring headlines of our national political scene, tough as that is to do, there's a lot happening in state politics. One way or another, Alaska's elected officials say they will be making big changes to the way this state raises and spends money. The 30th legislature is underway, and I spoke with Speaker of the House Bryce Edgman from Dillingham yesterday for an update.
Well, it's been a real busy start to the session. Already we're in the third week, and a lot of the activity has been centering around, of course, the budget process and maybe more pointedly, the fiscal future of the state. I think at this point, in comparison to last session, you have virtually everybody, every legislator, making it their highest priority to look at the long-term fiscal health of the state as number one issue.
I get the press releases from various members of the Senate and House and their caucuses and such, and I'm starting to see a little bit of shaping up of priorities as to how those long-term solutions will be addressed. What's your take on who's going to what corner and what looks like it might be a feasible solution to the long-term? Do you see anything taking shape?
First off, like I was saying a moment ago, it's everybody's priority to get something done this year. In a significant way. What that something done is going to be a matter of time. I think that there seems to be a fair amount of support for a motor fuels tax, although, we're still in the exploratory process figuring out what the tax does to, for somebody like me, what it means for rural communities. And the House Finance Committee, as we are speaking here today, is meeting on the governor's permanent fund restructuring plan. And I think there seems to be a fair amount of support both in the House and the Senate for that. And I expect that to be a bigger topic as we get towards the, the end of the session. The broad-based tax proposals that probably are going to emerge, whether it's a statewide sales tax or statewide income tax, there seems to be less support for doing that. But we're still in the early stages, and, I would just ask everybody to stay tuned on that.
Well, we have you on the phone. I'd like to ask about one more piece of legislation that we saw this week pertaining to this region, which was Representative Josephson, HB 14. He'd like to add more protection, another layer of review, it looks like, to what was passed with the Bristol Bay Forever Initiative in 2014. It seemed to meet with some quick resistance in the Fisheries Committee, at least with some of the members. How do you feel about that bill? Is it moving in the right direction?
Well, the whole issue of the elephant in the room, the pebble mine, I think is coming our way. And the bill is just sort of one piece of that whole issue coming back in front of the legislature in one way or the other. I think I'm scheduled to meet with the Pebble Partnership CEO next week or the week after. But the bill itself, I did get the one hearing. I don't know if there's another hearing scheduled. Honestly, I don't know. I don't think that there's enough support to get the bill through both the House and the Senate, but That's one that we'll be definitely keeping an eye on. And, you know, I think everybody knows my concern. I put the fishery and the habitat first, and I've been pretty clear on that. So we'll see where the bill goes.
Bryce Edgman represents District 37 and is the Speaker of Alaska's House. Bryce, thanks so much for the time, as always, on this program, and we'll speak again soon, I'm sure.
Dave, it was my pleasure. All the best, and talk to you soon.
Let's get some reaction from the public on what they see happening in Juneau. UAF Professor Mike Davis takes a class to the state's capital each year for many, many years now to meet with a wide variety of folks who have a hand in running this state, writing and enforcing its laws, and casting votes on behalf of their constituents. Evelyn Trifon from New Haven was on this year's class again, but when I spoke with her yesterday, she was back in Juneau on behalf of her local electric co-op. This was her third time she's been with the class trip.
Well, the first time I took the class with Mike Davis, it was 2015. So legislators were just starting to wake up and realize what was going on with the financial, the fiscal situation the state was facing. Nothing really happened that year, per se, as far as solutions or finding other revenues or reforming oil tax credits. So 2015 legislation session ended. 2016 started. I went back for the class again, heard kind of the same thing. More legislators are realizing what a big, huge financial situation the state of Alaska was facing. And it was also an election year. So, of course, being an election year, I was hopeful, but I didn't expect much results as far as solutions for such as an income tax or capping the PFD or things like that. And as we know, no new sources of revenue were really found, and there were more cuts to various sources of income throughout the budget. So here we are now with a new session, 2017, and every legislator is on board with finding a solution this session. I really, truly hope that they are able to find a solution. It can't be done with just cuts. It can't be done with just revenue. It needs to be a combination of cuts and revenue. And I think most legislators are on board with those ideas.
All right. So that's the, I'd say most people would view that as a positive change in the political atmosphere there. But what's not going so well?
I think the only negative side that I've seen so far is just the freshman legislators or freshman urban legislators that just don't understand rural Alaska yet. And I hope that I can facilitate in some of the education on what we face really in rural Alaska. And that's kind of my driving mission on the side, I guess, is to help enlighten urban Alaskans or urban legislators what we face in rural Alaska and how it really is.
Okay, three quick ones to wrap up with. Number one, are we going to have a PFD next year? Number two, will we have any money left in our state savings accounts? And number three, are you thinking of running for office yourself?
Number one, I'm hopeful that there will be a PFD. I think, and I was actually told this morning that long gone are the days of the $2,000 PFD. And even if you looked at the average, because the PFD, of course, is based on the formula of the past 5 years average, and then they pay out whatever that number is. The past 4 years, definitely the past 3 years, have not been over $100 a barrel. So even if they did do the typical formula, you still wouldn't have a $2,000 PFD anymore. So I think that, me personally, I think that they need to cap, or what I'd like to say better is to preserve the PFD at $1,000. So that we will have it for 20 plus years. If they do not preserve it at $1,000 this session, this year, then we will only have it for a couple of years and our savings accounts will be depleted. For our state savings accounts, with the legislators, and I rely on their expertise because they're the ones sitting there with the information for what the legislators say, we have about 2 years of savings left. Once that savings is gone, we have nothing. We have nothing to fall back upon. We've used that rainy day fund enough. We need to plug up the hole and stop relying on the rainy day fund and actually find some income to refill our buckets. And then the third question is, yes, I do plan on running for the legislation, probably not for several years, but I do plan on running at some point.
We'll be excited to see when that development comes about. And Evelyn Trifon from New Halen, who's down in Juneau, offering a good update here. Good always to talk with you, and thanks so much for this.
You too, Dave. Thank you very much.
And KDLG's Avery Lill tracked down most of the rest of the students from around the region who attended that class 2 weeks ago. Here's what some of them had to say.
Lindsay Leyland, and I am the Operations Director at United Tribes of Bristol Bay. Obviously, there was overarching was the state fiscal crisis, which all the legislators brought up and spoke to us at length about. But my classmates and I were also able to bring up some of the issues that kind of hit close to home. And we, as a group, kind of unanimously came forward with thoughts on the power cost equalization project and some concerns about Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve and whether or not large-scale sulfide mining, kind of what the regulations are going forward with that, and just other rural concerns about how adjusting for the state fiscal crisis would affect us.
Hi, my name is Greg Marksmuller. I work as Outreach and Education Coordinator here at SAFE. I'm a fisherman in Dillingham and have been since 91. There's a few bills that are really important to my work and also my interests. For the work ones, there's the rape kit testing bill that's going through to make sure that we don't have this backlog of, you know, kits that haven't even been tested. I think the fisheries reserve will be really important, and that bill going through, it's kind of strengthens what's already there and takes care of some loose ends with the Bristol Bay Reserve fishery.
My name is Carol Luckhurst, and I am a resident of Dillingham. I've lived here pretty much all of my life, born and raised here. The budget crisis, that was, everybody talked about it. Some of the things that they kind of laid out for their, how they would generate some of the revenue. There were things that they talked about, the state sales tax, the restructuring of the PFD, and the state income tax. And also the governor talked about the motor fuel tax.
My name is Gwen Larson. I'm from Dillingham. I grew up here. Well, you can tell the difference between the rural people were really more leading towards an income tax because it would affect the rural people a lot less. And then the urban people seem to more favor the sales tax because then they think it's spread fairly, but yet really it's not, because rural people have more higher expenses for goods and stuff than the urban people.
Hi, my name is Werner Wilson. I am the Director of Natural Resources for the Bristol Bay Native Association, and I was born and raised in Dillingham. One of the issues that my department is concerned about is budget cuts to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and other environmental and natural resource agencies. So I think that's something that we'll all be watching. And there's also issues related to Pebble and others that I think a lot of people in Bristol Bay are going to be seeing what the legislature and the governor do in the next 90 days. And so it was really an honor to be able to go and talk with our leaders about the pressing issues in the legislature.
Voices from the region from the recent Juneau class trip produced in a piece there by KDLG's Avery Lill. Continuing our program this week, Naknek and King Salmon are in a borough. 17 communities from Port Allsworth to Perryville are in a borough. But the western communities of Bristol Bay from Koliganik down to Togiak are not. The draft version of the newest study looking into how a borough could be formed on this side of Bristol Bay has been published, and public comments are being taken. KDLG's Lawrence Hamilton has a look at the new study and what some stakeholders have to say about it so far.
The McDowell Group was hired to look into the feasibility of creating a borough for Dillingham and the surrounding communities in the existing Southwest Region School District. The report was released in December and spelled out the mechanics, the process, and financial implications of forming a borough. Study author Susan Bell said the study was a good opportunity to find common ground, and it revealed enough potential revenue does exist to make the borough a reality.
A takeaway is that if there's a will, whether it's to improve economic development or education or regional cooperation, that there is a tax base to support it. There's no question that there's economic activity in the region. There would be sufficient financial resources to pay for borough formation.
The study acknowledged the challenges of borough formation. Some concerns quickly surfaced about a higher tax burden, loss of village control over local resources, and more power centralized in Dillingham. Bell said apprehension to a property tax and a large fishery tax led the study to look into a broader revenue stream.
There's an interest in making sure that different aspects of the economy, not only fishing, are contributing to regional costs. There was some time, additional time spent on looking at the visitor industry and the lodges and their location.
The borough proposals laid out in the study have not yet found much support within the census area. Herman Nelson Sr. is the president of the Kalignik Village Council.
Once you become a borough, one of the things that in the future that they would do is start taxing the communities, and we don't want that.
Nelson believes villages will lose control of the resources in a borough. Taxes will increase, and Dillingham would benefit the most.
I don't think that a borough is such a good thing for our communities now, because the thing that we talked about boroughs before is when you have a borough, you suck in all these smaller villages, and the one that usually end up benefiting off of everything is that wherever the biggest population is, and we don't want that. It definitely would be an extra burden.
The city of Manicotic has opposed past borough plans, and Mayor Melvin Andrew says it likely will again.
Several factors. Mainly, they don't want another form of government over their heads. Also, their fear, which I can say for myself too, is the revenue generated or created by the borough, the outlying communities besides Dillingham will have a smaller share, if not none at all.
Togiak City Administrator Daryl Thompson said people in the village simply can't afford to pay more taxes.
We're very poor in the rural villages. I mean, there's not a lot of income. And what income, and I have people living in the village, they have to make a decision. Do we buy heating oil and keep our home warm, or do we buy food and feed our family?
According to the study, the benefits of a borough include possible improvements to education, regional economy, and quality of life. These would come through an increase in tourism revenue and more control of more land. Caroline Smith, the mayor of Aleknagik, says that this is one of the most important positives to forming a borough in western Bristol Bay.
The good point, and this would be particularly important for people that are in opposition to any large-scale mining, would be a borough would take in the area of the Dillingham census area, and it would provide land use management input. Another aspect of a borough is that you get a much bigger and louder political voice in Juneau and elsewhere.
This is not the first time the matter has been studied, but Susan Bell said there was added emphasis this time to bring tribal governments into the process.
You know, a key question on the table is what are the roles of tribes if this was pursued? And there's a lot of flexibility there.
The study is in its draft form, so some, like the City of Dillingham, are withholding comment until the proposals are finalized. The next meeting of the Borough Formation Task Force is scheduled for March. In Dillingham, I'm Lawrence Hamilton.
Last night, the Dillingham City Council voted unanimously to appeal a recent decision by the Local Boundary Commission that overturned its earlier approval of a petition to annex the Nooshigak Bay to collect a fish tax. The process has gotten muddled and confused, even for those of us paid to keep an eye on it. I asked Dillingham City Attorney Brooks Chandler to join for his take. Chandler has been critical of the way the LBC has conducted itself and will be in charge of filing the appeal on behalf of the city. I asked him first to explain what that will be.
What that means is that there will be a Superior Court judge that will review the record of the action taken by the LBC in denying the city's petition for annexation, and that review will determine whether the decision was legally sound.
Now, I don't really want to rehash any of the merits of or against Dillingham's annexation petition. That has been well vetted, and I think both sides had good arguments to make. But what I would like to ask your opinion on here this morning is, as that process unfolded, it seemed that it sort of got off the rails. What was your take?
I was very disappointed, if not to say frustrated, by how the decision-making at the LBC unfolded. And that is, as you might mention, independent of the result. There are two aspects to, you know, any kind of legal dispute that I get involved in, and one is the result, but the other one is the process. And the process that I think the citizens of Dillingham were entitled to receive was something quite a bit more orderly and logical than what unfolded at the commission decisional meetings.
For those who didn't listen into those meetings, how so? What do you think happened that didn't that sort of skewed the normal process or procedure?
Well, I can't understand exactly what was going through the minds of commissioners, but there were a couple of things happened that I thought were strange. It appeared that people voted at decisional meetings either inconsistently or contrary to what they actually felt should be done, which is difficult to understand. And then the other aspect of the process that I thought was strange is the decision essentially to of the commission to change its mind. And it appeared to me that the city had put forward a fairly powerful and persuasive presentation during the public hearing in Dillingham, and that one of the entire concepts and purposes of a public hearing is to provide folks the attempt to, you know, persuade the commissioners who are making their decision. And the following day, they made a decision. And I think it appeared that as time went by and the impact of the in-person presentation faded, commissioners decided to change their mind, which I think is not what people would typically expect in a decision-making process. There's an obligation to make your decision, and then it's done. It's final. You move on.
Alaskans put a lot of faith and trust in boards and commissions and committees to make a lot of decisions at state levels, at lower levels and such. If the LBC gets a little bit out there, if they start straying, what exactly is what's a layer of protection against that, or what's a course correction that's available?
Well, judicial review is a standard part of our legal system in this country, and one of the reasons and functions of a judge reviewing an agency or commission action is to make sure both that there's some logic in the actual outcome and that the proper procedures and regulations were followed in the process. Can the board ignore its own regulations? And Mr. Harrington in particular appeared to dismiss them as, I think the word he used was a technicality. And, you know, from somebody from, you know, my perspective, views regulations and statutes as not technicalities, but as law that the board is bound to follow. And one of the main, you know, procedural issues will be, does the reconsideration regulation allow the board simply to show up 6 weeks later and say, you know, we changed our mind, or whether there has to be something a little bit more to it than that.
Brooks Chandler is an attorney for the city of Dillingham and is assisting the city in its attempts to annex the Neuschag Bay, a matter which seems unsettled as of yet. Brooks, thanks so much for the commentary and the context, and we'll talk again soon.
You're welcome, Dave.
And finally this week, many law enforcement agencies have some means of communicating their whodunits to the public, but few have gained the worldwide following of Unalaska's police blotter. By way of example, on a Sunday evening last November, assistance was rendered. Officers responded to a report of a mutiny aboard a vessel tied to the dock. Investigation revealed that a new captain had been fired for his inability to run the vessel in a safe manner and was upset at being disrespected by the vessel's owner. No criminal activity was discovered. There at the edge of Western civilization, where thousands of sailors and fishermen transit and drink, one officer took it upon herself to pack a little witty punch to the department's dispatches. But with a recent promotion, she's putting down her pen. KDLG's Avery Lill reports on the end of an era.
Soon after the Unalaska Police Department began publishing their police blotter, they put Jennifer Shockley, then a staff sergeant, in charge.
It was something that our department decided we wanted to do to basically let the public know what their police officers were busy doing on a day-to-day basis.
A lot of police stations have blotters. Not a lot of those have an international following, but Shockley says her blotter began making waves early on.
It developed a following very quickly. Mail was forwarded to me from people across the country, from Tennessee, Florida, the Midwest.
Readers appreciated her blotter's dry humor. It gave them a window into the lives of police officers in a bustling international fishing port in the faraway Aleutians. Aside from being published often verbatim in local weeklies like the Bristol Bay Times Dutch Harbor Fisherman, the Unalaska Police Blotter gained national attention, with articles in the LA Times, Washington Post, and NPR. Writing the blotter was time-consuming, Shockley says. So, exercising her expansive vocabulary and comically understating the absurd situations law enforcement handles was Shockley's way to make the chore more palatable.
It wasn't really so much a conscious decision, more just a style that developed over the years. I enjoy creative use of words, so I peppered the blotter with a couple of interesting words. I tried to put some humor in situations where I could, not so much trying to poke fun at people, but sometimes situations are funny, you know, a little bit absurd, and I would try to find those and highlight those kind of oddball situations that police officers everywhere run into.
These are some of the records that appeared in the Bristol Bay Times over the years.
Officers investigated a report of an assault that occurred between two besotted individuals. The two had a disagreement concerning one of the sots consuming the alcohol of the other sot. Sot 1, the owner of the alcohol, chased Sot 2, the consumer of the alcohol, down a hallway of a bunkhouse. None involved wished to pursue charges.
A drunken disturbance. Officers intervened in a disturbance between two quote-unquote brothers who had been exchanging some brotherly love. In the guise of a pugilistic engagement, as the two brothers were not in fact actual brothers and neither wished to pursue charges, both were placed into separate taxis and sent on their way.
Suspicious person/slash activity. A drunken man had phoned the police and said he was naked, cold, and exposing himself to passing vehicles and in need of assistance. He was unable to name or describe his location. Officers searched the common and not-so-common haunts of naked drunks but did not find the man in question.
Animal. Call reported that someone was feeding the eagles, causing a hazard as one of the eagles had flown into her truck. Officers investigated and discovered that the eagles were not being fed but were congregating, as eagles are known to do.
Shockley was promoted to deputy chief about a year ago, and putting her witty spin on calls for service is no longer in her wheelhouse. She says the department doesn't have the staff to keep up the blotter.
We're not doing it right now because of staffing issues. It's something that takes about 8 to 10 hours a week to do. We're operating at about 60% to 70% capacity with our staffing right now, and we just really need to spend our time focusing on law enforcement activities.
As this cop-turned-author with an international following reflects on her years maintaining the blotter, Shockley says a few of the stories have stuck with her.
We had an incident with a young man riding a bicycle down the sidewalk late at night. He had blood on himself, and when he was stopped by an officer, he told the officer that his girlfriend had turned him on to vampirism, but he wanted to get out of it, and he was on his way to the Catholic Church to be exorcised. We had another one involving a bicyclist being chased by a herd of feral horses. A woman who called up from Texas, I believe it was, wanting to know if the police department had ever heard of her fiancé. And when she found out that we were well acquainted with her fiancé, wanted to know whether we thought that she should marry him. So those are a couple of the ones that I know I personally thought were pretty funny.
Shockley will miss writing up the week's shenanigans, and she knows the readers will miss it too. Calls for the Unalaska police to respond to drunken sailors, sinister eagles, and unruly horses won't stop, but writing about them will. At least for now. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
And that's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. We appreciate the feedback and those story ideas. Keep sending them to dave@kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger. My thanks to Lawrence Hamilton and Avery Lill for their help this week. We hope you enjoy what's shaping up to be another beautiful weekend here in Bristol Bay, and we'll see you next Friday.